Yeah, you know, I would say all my favorite conversations were often about bugs and really, really bad bugs. Because one of the ways to get even like the most, you know, kind of shoegazing developer to talk for hours and to like in that Howard Cosell way, you know, unburden their emotional lives is to say something like, so what's like the worst bug you've dealt with here?
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Stack Overflow podcast for the week of November 4th. We're going to be talking quantum supremacy. We've got a great guest on, Clive Thompson, who'll be talking about his new book, Coders, and his favorite way to get developers talking, which is to ask them about the worst bug they've ever had to deal with. Here we go.
This is Ben Popper. I'm here with my wonderful co-hosts, Paul and Sarah. Say hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody.
Paul, I was at an event last night, and Sarah was in transit because she's a champion.
Mm-hmm.
So she was supposed to speak at 7:15, but the plane landed at 6:50 in Newark.
Yeah.
So
where's your helicopter?
Yeah.
The Stack Overflow helicopter is being used by our new CEO.
That totally makes sense. There's Sarah's room to land it in the office.
Exactly. Sarah's helicopter is still being prepared. It was a custom order, so it's going to take a while.
The community helicopter. Yeah.
I got it chromed out.
The community copter. So they were like, well, Sarah was going to give this presentation, but nobody else is here. And I was like, I'll just do it. Okay, let's do it. So I gave the presentation as Sarah, which, you know, got a few laughs.
It's good.
And I made it halfway through. And I was basically just selling our team's product. I was like, here's why people like it. Knowledge sharing, modern this, chat that, blah, blah, blah.
Hold on. Our team's product is Stack Overflow for Teams?
Correct.
Okay. Come on, Ben. Come on. We're doing this here.
Okay.
Let's stop pretending that this is something it isn't.
No. But I'm not trying to sell the product right now. There will be an interlude somewhere in this podcast.
Because we all know what this is, including the audience.
Yeah. Stack Overflow for Teams.
That's right.
Yeah, Teams? Stack Overflow for Teams.
Stack Overflow for Teams. I'm so ready.
But then the point of the talk is supposed to be how we built
it. Because you're a loser.
So I made it through,
I mean, it's the same as
12 slides? I made it through 12 of 24 slides, and then I get to this slide. ASP.NET Core, SQL Server, TypeScript, no frameworks, Redis. And I was like, this is the point where I can't continue to fake it. And I was like, God, I wish Sarah was here. And then Sarah was like, I'm here. And everybody
laughed. Oh, my God. That's good.
It was good. It was
okay,
a good
first
moment.
Of all, we got to just back it out a little bit. ASP.NET. It's not a snake.
ASP.NET was how I would have pronounced it if I had to.
I didn't even catch that.
If
I
had to
ASP.
Do the presentation. So I'm glad I didn't have to do it.
Oh, boy.
I'm going to get a pet snake. Name it ASP.NET.
Active server snake. What is ASP is active server pages, right?
It is. Did you ever do one of those?
I did something very similar known as PHP for quite a while.
I never
got into anything that had a .NET at the end.
Just like as an aside, I met someone last night who was like at Bell Labs and they worked on like the original Unix. And I was like, oh, you're an old programmer. You should be friends with Paul.
Oh, that's cool.
I actually said the same thing to that guy.
Really?
I said, you should come on the podcast. Paul would love to talk to you.
It is true. I do like ye olden programmers.
We're going to have Tyrone on the podcast.
Great.
Wait, who?
Tyrone.
He runs the meetup that we have.
Runs the meetup, which was like a people of color code meetup. And he runs like several meetups.
Yeah.
He's been doing Unix and Linux for 30 years. He was at Bell Labs. And then he was like, and then I went to a bank and created derivatives and ruined the world. But anyway, let's talk about coding.
There's a lot of overlap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So what is today? What are we doing? What a beautiful view. It's a pretty day.
It's a pretty day, and we're here to talk about quantum supremacy.
Oh my God.
Can someone talk to me about quantum supremacy?
Well, here was my idea, and I think we should definitely make an effort. You and I should try to explain what quantum computing is, because it'll entertain our audience. And then we should actually go and use Stack to figure out what the hell is happening.
If I do that, people are going to yell at me on the internet.
No, because we're going to be vulnerable in public. Because people ask me from time to time, because they're like, you explain things about code. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, my kind of code. Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
So first of all, here's what I do know. It looks like Google has achieved quantum supremacy. This sounds terrifying.
It really does.
Sounds like robot overlord time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, for some reason, the other day I woke up and all I could think was, how would a Kennedy pronounce quantum? And would it be quantum or would it be quantum?
Quantum supremacy.
Everybody, yeah, I think
quantum supremacy.
We have achieved quantum supremacy. I mean,
well, actually, that was what I was thinking too. Was like this was a it was leaked out of NASA, right? By accident.
That's right.
They were like doing it in partnership with them or something.
Yeah, it was a whistleblower.
So the actual developer story is who was the web developer at NASA who accidentally published this paper when it was not yet ready.
Now, instead of quantum supremacy, let's talk about content management.
Yeah,
something I do understand.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, there are a lot of ways to not publish that PDF, friends.
Yeah.
But when you say quantum supremacy, it does sort of sound space racy. Like, we've done it. You can't mess with us now. We can crack all the ciphers. We can make all the Bitcoin. Like, everybody stand back.
All that's really going on here, to my understanding from reading articles in places like Vice, is that, so quantum computing is a thing that, again, let's not even try to explain it, but there's a way of... Oh, God.
Here's how I think of it. Like, sometimes there are real computers doing, like, things like ones and zeros. But imagine if there were pretend computers doing that as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Wow. Hold on. You guys missed it, but Sarah just ate a weed gummy in the middle of it.
No, that was a Schrodinger's cat kind of thing, right? One of the computers is alive and one of them is dead,
yeah,
but you don't know which one.
You don't know.
And they can exist at the same time.
But they're pretend.
I'm on year 20 of not understanding quantum computing. And it is like you just sort of lean into the microphone and say, superpositions.
Yeah. I think here's my explanation. So we were doing this before. You know, the normal computer has ones and zeros, can flip the light switches really fast, but there's certain things that would just take it forever.
Yeah.
The quantum computer has qubits, which are both ones and zeros at the same time magically. And that means for whatever reason, it can solve a problem in a day that would take a normal computer 50,000 years. Hence, you can do things like crack all these cryptographic hashes and make all the Bitcoin, right?
That's right.
Wow, Ben just explained quantum computing to me in a way I could really understand.
This is just like the press release was scheduled for Monday. We were supposed to publish in Nature, and accidentally on Friday, the webmaster.
That's a bad day at NASA. That is not a good scene.
Wait, when you're like, NASA's a webmaster?
They probably do, actually.
Yeah,
that job's probably been there for like 24 years. There are still webmasters in the world, and I salute you, webmasters.
But that's what happened. They accidentally published a web page. The Financial Times, you know, just has an RSS feed that picks it all up. And they were like, what? Quantum supremacy. And ran with it.
Yeah.
You know what the problem is
here? And then they took
the
web page down.
Continuous integration.
That's right.
Kill
that's
it.
Right. Or just update the CMS and do a scheduled publishing module. But regardless, so this is a big deal in a very abstract way that won't actually affect most of our lives, unless like suddenly now that this is unlocked, I mean, there'll be more energy and time on it. Maybe there'll be some real progress, and we'll be able to, you know, factor a whole bunch of large primes or whatever the hell it is that they're going to do to break all the cryptography.
Yeah.
Speaking of Bitcoin,
how does Stack explain anything quantum? There is like a whole quantum stack, right?
Yes, there's a whole
Stack
Exchange.
I don't spend a lot of time there.
Quantum computing.
Is it quantumcomputing.stackexchange.com?
It is quantumcomputing.stackexchange.com. Why does entanglement not increase the classical capacity of a channel? I mean, this is, it sounds like, you know, science fiction, because there's questions like, evaluate the following teleportation equation, as if teleportation, you know, is a thing that
normal thing
you just normally do. So the most upvoted question ever on this Stack Exchange, is quantum computing just pie in the sky? Asked 1 year and 3 months ago. We now know the answer is no. But
when you hear that, do you hear the song "Eye in the Sky" by Alan Parsons Project?
Nope.
No, nobody else does. Nope. Just me. But I am the pie in the sky.
Yeah. When this question was answered a year ago, it says so far it's looking this way. We have been reaching for this pie aggressively over the last 3 decades, but with not much success. We do have quantum computers now, but they are not the pie we wanted, which is a computer that can actually solve a problem faster or with better energy efficiency than a classical computer.
It's not the pie in the sky. Okay, so that is... So, okay, a whole new way of seeing and understanding computing has shown up. And this is a podcast that celebrates, because here we are with Stack, not knowing the answer to anything.
Totally.
And so anyway, if you're out there and you're going, what the hell is all this quantum computing? And trust me, having followed this on and off for a long time and refused to really understand it, as I see journalists writing about it, I know for a fact they don't really understand it either.
Yeah.
And so we're all going to get there together over the next 10 or 15 years.
Yeah.
Like Bitcoin.
Well, now, see, this is a real thing that relates to physics as opposed to a fake thing that relates to bugs in human consciousness. And so every time you say buy Bitcoin, I'm just going to go fight global warming. It's just...
Hey, everybody. We have a great guest with us here in the studio this week, Clive Thompson, journalist, developer, musician, and author of the recent book, Coders. Paul, you know Clive. I'm going to let you two kick it off.
You wrote a book about code called Coders.
Yeah,
it's about programmers.
Programmers.
How many interviews did you do for the book?
Oh, my God. I mean, someone asked me this, so I actually went into my database and tried to look at
it. Okay, that's a tell.
There we go, tell. I would say for the book, I did about 200 interviews with developers that were ranged from the kind of, like, fully I'm shadowing them for a day, you know, down to, like, we talked for an hour, you know, on the phone, down to I was at a company and I was, like, hanging out with them and running into ones going, hey, can we talk in depth for half an hour here?
Clive, do you want to know my worst nightmare?
What?
Having to talk to 200 developers.
Yeah, yeah. That's what most of them said to me, actually. I said,
It is true. As a community, sorry, you probably agree, like, we are aware of how exhausting we are.
Yeah. No, that's definitely very true. That's definitely, I've definitely talked to 200 developers a week.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I think the only other people I that were in that wheelhouse were, you know, high up managers and, you know, product leaders who would be like, oh yeah, I have 40 people that I talk to all week long. They're all developers. And, you know, that's why you have to pay me this much money, right?
You know? I mean, the reality is, I still love talking to developers.
Yeah.
There's nobody like developers.
Can you share some of the interesting conversations you had?
Yeah, you know, I would say all my favorite conversations were often about bugs and really, really bad bugs. Because one of the ways to get even like the most, you know, kind of shoegazing developer to talk for hours and to like in that Howard Cosell way, you know, unburden their emotional lives is to say, what's like the worst bug you've dealt with here? And like they'll light up, you know, because like, I mean, it's kind of waiting for someone to ask them that. Like,
no one does.
Something that tortured them. And some of these ones went on for like, you know, some of them were like, you know, they were done in a day. They were really bad, but they were done. Some of them took weeks. Some took years. Some were literally never were solved and destroyed the corporation, right?
There's an Alan Ullman novel called The Bug.
The Bug, exactly. No, that's sort of where I got the idea from because I love that novel. Alan Ullman is just literally one of the best writers on software kind of ever, in nonfiction too, right?
Agreed.
She just writes amazing essays. And that story about the bug has sort of, it became a kind of a useful way to think about, you know, the narrative value of bugs, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a detective story, you know, it's like there was this mystery and I am the detective and I'm looking for the clues. And yeah, so there was like Rob Spector, this wonderful developer for when I met him, he just finished working for Twilio. He was hard to work for this game.
Rob. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's great. He was hard to work for this game company in the 90s or early 90s or early aughts, late 90s or early aughts. And it was doing one of these multiplayer games back when the state of the art in that was pretty ragged. Mm-hmm. Like people didn't really know how to do it reliably. And they had just created a terrible engineering for it. It had, like, it was what you would now call, you know, microservices, like a lot of, but it was not organized
Like over-architected.
And they were all allowed to, like, write each other's memory. So, like, it was just, it was completely memory unsafe nightmare. And they had this one bug that they could never figure out, and it killed the company. They never launched the game.
Wow.
Like, they wrestled with it for years.
Wow.
And they never got that game to have more than 100 people live at the same time.
Wow. Wow. Never figured out, meaning, like, they couldn't identify the source or they couldn't solve it without having to rebuild everything?
They literally couldn't. No one could figure out in the hairball of code what was causing it. You're right. There are times when they can figure out the source and they're like, all right, we are stuck here because like we cannot re-engineer the code base to fix this. So let's just cover it with a layer of dirt and like a switch case that's 17 feet long, you know. But no, this one that it was literally like it was a mystery, and they just all like just walked away.
That's great.
And sometimes the stories are like kind of funny. Like there's a story, the team that did Code for America that did this amazing project on food stamps for San Francisco and then for California. You know, they created this amazing app that allowed people to apply much more easily for food stamps. It used to be like this 45-page nightmare of unresponsive pages that was useless on the inexpensive phones that the average person would use. They re-engineer it. Then for like just for fun, they're like, hey, let's make it so you can check your food stamp balance like with a text message, because up until then it was this You had to, this phone tree you had to go mm-hmm. through, and it was really a pain in the butt. Everyone hates phone trees. So they create this, and then they're like, hey, this works really well. And they take out Facebook ads saying, you can check your food stamp balance, right? And then the lead engineer goes off to Fiji for the weekend, or whatever, mm-hmm. for a week, I guess. And in the middle of it, suddenly this process starts firing. Instead of like 100 times a day, it starts firing like thousands of times, like a minute, basically. Mm-hmm. And they can't figure what's going on. And it's going to like drown out their budget for SMS messages. And finally, when they realized what happened was that someone had taken the phone number that you're supposed to text and inputted that as the thing texted to the service, right? They texted the service's own phone number. Instead of texting, here's my food stamp number, uh-huh. give me back my amount, they texted the phone number to the phone number.
They just wow. set up an
and it just set up
loop.
An infinite oh loop goodness. Of texting itself. Like they had, they, in that classic sense, they had not predicted something weird that a user would do, and the user broke the system. Yeah. And over again, I heard stories of that. Like, yeah, we thought of like the 5,000 weird use cases, and we didn't predict 5,001, and everything went into a tower of flames, basically.
When you were talking to Joel earlier, you guys were talking about what are the on-ramps and how more and more there are these new cultural on-ramps. One of the great ones that I think Sarah and I have been seeing a bunch of is people live coding on Twitch, and then you can follow along and learn from them. People have been doing live question-answer sessions for Stack Overflow questions, and that's such a cool one because like that looking over the shoulder thing was never possible, you know, 5-10 years ago. Nobody was doing it like that.
You know what's changed? It used to be a slower process with trial and error. Sometimes, you know, you'd wait for the compile and it took forever. And it required people to kind of focus on one relatively abstract task for 20 days at a time.
That's right.
Now we are slinging code all over the place. It is like, I got my windowing toolkit and I'm going to make my React components, blah, blah, blah. I built a web app in 2 hours. Look at me. And like, that, so culturally, and I think a vast amount of the work day to day happens at that layer now.
Totally.
As opposed to like, I'm going to write my own streaming file system or just whatever the hell, like I just put two words together there. But like, you know, something really, the lower level stuff you don't need that much of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Bram Cohen, actually, the guy that did BitTorrent, Bram and I were hanging out, and he was saying, yeah, it's so weird watching, and he's not that old, but he's in his 40s, I guess, watching the generation of coders that, you know, he hires. And he has to have really good people because he's working on hardcore stuff. But nonetheless, he's like, yeah, you know, back in the 90s, you had to write everything yourself. It's like, oh, I need a server. Mm. Let me write server code myself. And now he's like, you know, there's like a library for kind of everything. Mm. So many more of these developers are just enormously skilled at being able to understand what are the capabilities at hand and how to stitch them together.
Mm. Right.
And that stitching and their understanding of what you can do with that becomes kind of the magic. And I think that's true.
Yeah. We got to bring Joel on for this one next time. Because that was his whole thing was he was like, kids today, they're just taping things together. They don't know how to build from first principles. That's why I'm going back to Arduino.
Right, exactly.
You know.
The big foundation, well, look, there's a true joy in messing around. Like Sarah, probably at this table, has done the most messing around at that layer.
Yeah.
You said it's really hard.
It is really hard. It's really easy in the beginning. Like you turn a light on and you're like, I'm a god.
Right.
Like I've done this amazing thing.
LED.
Yeah. And then you have to do anything at scale and it turns out to be like the hardest thing in the world. Like turning on a light with Arduino is too easy. It's kind of like the Ruby Hello world where you're like, oh, I can do anything in this.
I'm a programmer now.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually, no, you can just make a mess.
And plus like you're learning how to do those things and you've done it with your prototype, but then it's like, will this work when I manufacture a thousand of them, you know?
Scale changes everything.
This is eternal drama, though, because it's like, who's a real programmer? Is this foundational question built into all this? Because there's this legendary textbook called The Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programs, also known as SICP, which is, I hate saying
that
out loud.
Yeah, no.
SICP. But it was the MIT, I think, 6.001 electrical engineering class textbook. And it taught you Scheme, the language Scheme, which is, if people don't know it, it's a lot, it's based on Lisp. And it taught you everything in sort of like recursive functions. It's a short book. It's so dense. I've made it to chapter 2.5.
Wow.
They'll be like, oh, hey. You'll be like, oh, this is cool. I'm learning so much. And they'll be like, let's recursively calculate Ackermann's function. And you're like, oh, cool. Let's do that. And then they're like, yeah, we'll make a compiler. And it's like, you just, what the hell is happening?
Yeah.
So it's this very dense, very amazing book that completely defined computer science at MIT for like 25 years. And then they're like, yeah, we're going to do this in Python. And people lost their minds.
Yeah.
They were just like, what? No, you're going to take away Scheme. But they're like, this isn't how it works anymore. Like, you you glue stuff together, you move robots around.
Yeah.
Like, you're assembling things out of the world rather than starting from first principle.
Well, and I talked to all these developers from the 90s who, like, had to think incredibly hard about the the read write capacities of servers, spinning servers, right?
Yeah.
And like there were like it was nothing but race conditions. You know, they were just constantly thinking about race conditions, and they became just amazing in that matrix-like way of being able to stare at a log error and go, all right, race condition here, fix that. And that's those skills are completely unnecessary now.
Yeah. Unless you're Amazon and Google, it still matters a little bit. Like where you have a billion pieces of hardware and getting 1% performance increase by taking into account the way the hard drive is spinning because you're still using spinning rust over here.
Right.
But you probably only need a couple hundred of those people.
Or if you're like Google and you're creating Spanner to sort of manage time across the planet, right? You know, but this point about who's a real programmer and coding, and you know, Ben, going back to this thing of like, you know, Joel being interested in the Arduino because that's real code. You know, there's no libraries or there's fewer libraries. You're exactly right, Paul. This is like one of the foundational fights in development, because like back in the really early days when, you know, Grace Hopper is writing some of the first compilers and trying to create some of the first languages, like her before COBOL, the language she created was the best name ever. It's called Flowmatic.
I love that.
FLOW-matic. I'm like, oh my God, I wish that still existed. So she's making this, and like it's causing a huge fight amongst that early and very small world developers. Mm-hmm. Like, no, we have to be writing in assembly and like maybe even in binary, because you know we won't understand what the machine is doing. You're going to create a generation of coders who don't really understand the machine if you create these languages that you know are compiled. So the very idea of compilers seemed like cheating.
Basically. And what was fascinating about that, this is from that great Slate article, is that she was doing it so that they could broaden the user base, right? So
exactly.
All these stuffy military suits who wanted to get into computers and maybe learn some more about atomic weaponry will be able to do it in plain language.
One thing I think all the services and this abstractions has created is a really difficult world for, it's made it even more difficult for ICs to advance and stay ICs.
Because not everybody is individual contributor.
Individual contributor.
Like, meaning programmer who works.
Yeah, programmer
not
who
a manager.
Works. Yeah, because it used to be you would, you know, go into architecture and get really deep, and now it's just like, use Kubernetes. Like,
watch the video.
Yeah, exactly. You're not dealing so much with memory and like server allocation. Like all that stuff is done for you. So you don't need someone at work to do that.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah.
You know what's baffling to me is how much software information and Kubernetes, enterprise software demos is all on YouTube. Like it's such a lore-driven and stand-up and talk-driven culture now.
Right.
And it's kind of the only way to keep up.
The phenomena of people learning stuff like via video is really interesting though, because like, so I encounter this a lot, you know, in the book too, like, you know, people learning stuff now by encoding by turning to a video as opposed to a book.
Mm-hmm.
And B, people upon deciding they want to teach other people something in coding, going, well, I'm going to do a Twitch stream or I'm going to do a video, but I'm not going to write an O'Reilly book anymore, right?
Yeah.
You sort of want to see what is going to happen on the screen. Mm-hmm. Like, you can sort of read the guide, but like, watching the blizzard of weird stuff and error messages that you're actually supposed to ignore because they're going to occur every time and they're meaningless is actually really useful when you're trying to do something.
All right, so this book came out a little while ago.
Yeah, it came out this spring, yeah.
What have you learned since it came out?
What have I learned since?
Because you write the book.
Yeah. The reaction is different between programmers and non-programmers, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in one sense, the non-programmers are sort of fascinated by the fact that like they didn't realize that I do a bunch of hobbyist coding myself, right? Mm-hmm. And particularly when they discover that I write a lot of scripts and apps just for use in my own journalism. So there's this kind of funny reaction from people that don't do software. There's a whole bunch of people who actually were really happy the book existed because they have a partner or a parent or a child who's a developer, and they're like, oh my God, thank you for explaining all this to me.
Thanksgiving is saved.
Yes, I just bought 9 copies of your books to hand out to everyone in the family. Developers are a much funnier and prickly audience.
Do they
fight
with you about your book?
So exhausting.
Well, I mean, like again, I would say it's a bimodal response. Half of them are like, thank you for writing this because it was actually nice to have something that I can hand to my partners and my children or my parents and say, here's what's going on. So they're really happy that I wrote it from the perspective of someone who actually likes and finds the art and craft and technical stuff admirable, right? You know, whenever I'm sort of talking about the politics and civic impact or, you know, the problems in the world of development, you know, the fact that it's systemically sealed out anyone except for like neckbearded white dudes for a long time, there's a strong reaction against that. You know, like to their credit, I suppose, they'll write this review that's like, this is all grievance nonsense. But wow, he seems to, the chapters where he wrote about bugs are fantastic.
Right.
They're against maybe their own desires. They actually like the chunks of the book that are just purely rawly about.
No, I like the part about the giant storm, but the global warming stuff is a little too much.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's so fascinating because, I mean, I think that's one of the higher order challenges we have here, right? Is that we continue to be a place where people love to come to ask and answer questions and to share knowledge, and we're struggling to make the community more diverse and inclusive. And a lot of people just say, stop doing that. We don't need to work on that. Right. Let's get back to our knitting. Like, you're annoying us.
Well, and the weird thing is this. It's like, so the contention of this latter group is that, you know, no social barriers exist. This is like, this is an area of pure merit, right? Mm. And of course they actually do. But what they're doing is they're sealing out the people who actually love the same things that the guys inside love. Like, they actually love the actual real feeling of merit, the idea that you have to wrestle with the silicon beast and get it to do exactly what you want. They love that feeling, that challenge, and the feeling of control that comes from it. And, you know, they actually, my God, you know, systemically subaltern groups are looking for nothing more than an area where actual merit really applies.
Yeah.
And so this is so delightful, this world exists. They want exactly what these guys also sort of want. If everyone could just recognize that there's these social problems that are everywhere else in society that we have to get rid of, then this world is just an amazing world that everyone who touches loves, right?
Okay, great. Thanks, everybody. Today's episode of the podcast is brought to you by Stack Overflow for Teams. The folks you work with have questions and they have answers. Stack Overflow for Teams connects the two. It's just like stackoverflow.com, the website you know and love, but it's an internal tool for your proprietary information only. Right now, you can head over to stackoverflow.blog/podcast and find a link to try it out, 25 seats free. So if you're a small startup or a mid-sized company with 25 engineers, you can try out Stack Overflow for Teams at no cost. Just head on over to stackoverflow.blog/podcast. So at the talk last night, Ian went first, and he was talking about
Ian is the developer here at Stack.
Great story about Ian. He was working as like a social worker.
It's a shame this guy doesn't have a last
name.
Ian Allen was working as a social worker, had no computer science training, but was in a basketball fantasy league and was like, I'm tired of losing, and Googled around and found some like interesting coding approaches and won the fantasy league that year. And then he was like, right, this is it. My new career is here.
Yeah. I love when they reach inside and find the nerd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
it's
literally opposite of like every teen movie where like the plain girl gets her hair done and is suddenly really cool.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm a cool social worker who's a friend and a helper, but I really want to win.
And I'm popular and I have lots of friends that want me in this fantasy basketball league.
But I
want
to win.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Lost many friends, won the fantasy league.
And then just there's this one day they wake up and they're like, I'm an excellent fantasy sports player. And you're just like, but what happened, Ian? What happened? Here he is at Stack.
Totally. No, he was like, I started going around and then all of a sudden it was like flow state. I was like spending days, you know, designing little routines to help me crunch the data on the fantasy league. And I was like, I actually kind of like this version of me where I don't talk to other people. I just hang out in my room all day. And it's like, well, cool. Like you got you're bit by the bug.
Ben, you're fascinating because you're right on the threshold. You're like, I'm a journalist. I talk to people, successful person, also MMA fighter. Right down the middle. And it was like, which way is he going to go? Is he going to go cool or is he going to come to Stack Overflow and learn how to program? Anyway, welcome. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, no, it's really cool. One of us.
I made it all the way through the JavaScript tutorial and I'm halfway through the basic CSS.
Oh, man.
And
CSS
so
is a plate of scrambled eggs. It makes no sense. JavaScript, you're like, okay, this is confusing.
I love
it seems
that analogy, a plate of scrambled eggs.
Because you're just like, A feeds into B, feeds into C, and then everybody's like, oh, well, you know, your divs have to burr, and you're just like, what, where?
Yeah, it just doesn't make any sense at all.
It's really hard
my
to debug.
My favorite talk is a talk, well, one of my top 10 favorite talks is a talk that Jacob Thornton gave called Cascading Shit Show, which is, you can find it online, and it's just all about how CSS was started and just like the news groups in the 90s of people saying dumb things.
Yeah.
Just like reading out loud those emails. It's hilarious. It's an amazing talk.
I mean, like, and then there's people like Eric Mayer who sort of bring calm to the chaos. And
yeah.
And there's a valid reason for it. It's just that we have too many things that are programming languages to choose from. And then the world's too flexible. And there should be a one guiding government that runs everything around technology. That's what I think.
No, I mean, it's called the W3C.
Yeah, and that doesn't work either. This is what happens when you allow people to make decisions as a culture and try to drive things forward. And sometimes it's a little messy.
Wait, isn't there, there are like silly governing bodies that like decide on the new emoji that gets created, right?
Oh, God,
like,
yeah. No, everything. Listen.
And if you could, they don't think they're silly.
Yeah.
You think they're silly.
Yeah,
I also think there's.
If you ever want to do like a 36-hour emergency podcast, just let's talk standards sometime. That is because it's where it all comes from. It's they're these secret governing bodies, and they're not secret. They're only secret because you just don't even want to know about it.
Right.
But yeah, like emoji. Somebody has to say when I hit Alt Shift 7 R C N that like something will happen.
I mean, the thing about CSS that I feel like is a little bit useful in terms of thinking about what it's like to be a programmer is when I was doing the HTML one, it just felt like there were keywords that you needed to memorize in order to change.
Not much debugging.
Yeah. But with CSS, there is that sense that you were saying before of like, if I give a higher order command, it can have these cascading effects, which, you know, I can use to my advantage to automate things and to give a certain sense of efficiency in a way that means I don't have to keep coming back and doing another P tag or whatever.
I mean, this is what's tricky. CSS is a declarative language, right? You say, here are some facts, and then the browser is supposed to interpret those facts about how things should look and interact, and then it's supposed to take that and make sensible decisions and sort of show you a much different looking version of a page than you'd normally see. But it's hard. Actually, it turns out that imperative, like modular languages are a little easier to keep in your head than large sets of rules.
Yeah, I think there's no syntactic sugar in CSS.
No, like, and that's why there's less and sass and sort of all these different preprocessors that make it more like programming.
Yeah.
And let it be nested and sort of all that stuff.
My best friend in the world is a huge CSS fan. I have two best friends in the world. Both of them like CSS, but one's a huge fan. And whenever we, literally, the way I pick a fight with her is I just say, CSS grid is tables.
No. Sarah, be gone. CSS grid is great.
It's tables. The end.
It's, no. No. If we say, no, the whole edifice comes down if you say it. No, trust me. Trust me. And I've done it all in tables.
Write your complaints to Brenda Storer on Twitter.
No. CSS Grid is good. Everyone should. If you don't know CSS Grid, you should go learn it. It is actually pretty cool.
I don't think it's bad. I just think it's tables.
It's not tables. Hold on. I have a tweet from back in the day. When faced with vertical aligned CSS challenge, always remember to do your utmost. UTMOST. Use tables. Move on. Save time. And I tweeted that, and not everyone agrees.
I love that.
Do your utmost. Use tables. Move on. Save time. That's not what I believe in my heart. I believe that good semantic, nicely orchestrated markup is the right way forward, and it helps with accessibility and overall makes the web more usable across different media.
And columns and rows. It turns out.
All right, it's that time. We're going to shout out our lifeboaters of the week. These are folks who found a question with a score of -3 or less. They went in and gave an answer, and now that question has a score of 20 or more. So thank you for saving these questions and spreading some knowledge. Our first award goes to Panag Sanketi. Can MLKit for Firebase be used for handwritten text? Our next goes to, and I know I'm going to butcher your name, so I apologize, Ojanugu Ochilufu, for answering the question, display HTML form values in the same page after submit. And last, a shout out to Gabriel, a pretty new user with 201 rep, how to open a huge SQL file. Great questions, great answers. Thanks to all our lifeboaters of the week. Thanks for listening. I'm Ben Popper. You can find me at Ben Popper on Twitter. I'm the director of content at Stack Overflow.
Hi, I'm Sarah Chips. Thanks for listening. I am the director of public Q&A here at Stack Overflow and Sarah J. Chips on Twitter.com.
I'm Paul Ford. I'm the co-founder of Postlight, a digital product studio. If you need me, send an email, paul.ford@postlight.com, or you can find me on Twitter at @ftrain.
And I'm Clive Thompson. I am the author of Coders, The Making of a New Tribe, and The Remaking of the World. I am Pomeranian99 on Twitter. There's a story behind that for another time. And I write for the New York Times Magazine and for Wired.
Awesome. Thanks for coming on.
Is the story that you have 99 Pomeranians?